You're listening to Carbon Removal Newsroom, a weekly show about current events in the world of carbon removal, from technology and innovation to policymaking and job growth. Brought to you by NORI, the carbon removal marketplace.
Hello, and welcome to the business edition of Carbon Removal Newsroom. Today, our panelists will be discussing recent developments in carbon removal purchases by Copenhagen Airport, Shell Environmental Products, and Swiss and Lufthansa Group. I'm Radhika Mulgafkar, VP of Supply and Methodology at NORI, and joining me as always, Susan Su, a partner focused on climate investing at Toba Capital, a board member at the Carbon Business Council, a board advisor to the Environmental Voter Project, and host of the Climate Money podcast. Hello, Susan. Welcome.
Hello.
We also have Naeem Merchant, the Executive Director of Carbon Removal Canada, an Elemental Accelerator Policy Fellow, and the author of The Carbon Curve, a newsletter and podcast about the policies and technologies needed to grow the carbon removal market. Hi, Naeem.
Hey, everyone. Good to be with you.
All right. Let's start with Shell's biochar purchase, which is interesting. Naeem, what do you think of Shell picking 22,500 biochar credits that have been certified by Puro Earth?
I think that the carbon removal community needs to kind of think about not stressing too much about, you know, who's buying biochar credits or carbon removal credits or other kind of, you know, or other sorts of carbon removal, you know, strategic purchases that make sense for them. So I don't really make much of it, to be really honest. Like, I think Shell is, like any other company, going to buy carbon removal credits that make sense for, you know, what they, you know, as a massive company with many different arms, is going to make sense for them. I think what we need to be more worried about is just like, what do companies like Shell that buy carbon removal technologies that have the potential to scale, and what companies like Shell decide to do with those technologies going forward. But I feel like as relates to this particular situation, it's really just about, you know, Shell being like any other major corporate polluter, deciding kind of to buy durable carbon removal. On balance, I think is a good thing. And it's not, their purchases of carbon removal credits shouldn't be the focus. The focus should be on, you know, what are they actually doing in relation to the scale up of carbon removal and the reduction of emissions of their own activities.
Do you, as a follow-up, have any concerns, because there is some debate about the durability and the permanence of biochar, and so choosing biochar versus another technological solution like another Bikers or BECCS pathway, how do you think about that, if at all?
I think we're getting a bit more kind of data around kind of the permanence of biochar, and we're seeing kind of, you know, more encouraging studies being done around just like the durability of biochar. I think there's a lot more to be done. And I think one of the concerns I have about biochar is just how much that varies based on climate conditions and soil conditions and all these sorts of things. But really, like, what I'm seeing here, big picture, is a company saying, let's buy 22,500 credits of biochar, you know, at, you know, $100-ish per ton, instead of a $5 carbon offset. And so for me, like, this is progress. And I have, like, you know, is biochar my personal favorite carbon removal method? In some ways, no, because of the kind of concerns that I just already raised. But I think that it's really encouraging to see more companies. And what we need to see is more companies, regardless of like where they are in the spectrum of how carbon intensive their specific industry is, buying, you know, more expensive, higher durability carbon removal credits. Like, directionally, this is exactly more of what needs to happen. Now, the question of like Shell and, you know, their broader business model and how they engage on climate is, like, you know, that's a broader discussion. But, you know, based on just kind of thinking about their specific decision here to be buying carbon removal or biochar credits from Puro, I think, you know, I think we're moving in the right direction. We need to see more. You know, so far we have seen high margin, low emissions companies make carbon removal purchases. And what we need to see are companies with a higher carbon intensive, coming from higher carbon intensity industries, like Shell, but like you know, in companies in steel and cement and all across heavy industry, you know, investing in carbon removal. So I'm encouraged that directionally, this is where we kind of want to see things go, where we have a broader spectrum of companies getting involved in the durable carbon removal market.
So Susan, you know, the next 150 plans to expand its biochar production capacity with at least two additional plants that are, you know, scheduled to come online in 2024 and 2025. What do you make of that, which announcement, which maybe signals that at least biochar is moving from early phase financing to more traditional style financing?
I think this is actually a very significant piece of news overall because of the things that you can read between the lines. First of all, the Next 150 is a company that has been in existence for, I'm like looking at my month and date here, about a year and some change. So it's a very new, it's a very young company, and yet they've already managed to get Shell as a partner, which, I mean, hello, that like not only everything that Naeem said, which I think was some really great points about not just these high margin, ultimately quite low emissions companies, but the opposite, but also it's just like a very big logo and it's a huge corporate player to be already partnering with at such an early stage of inception. We've had carbon removal companies that we all know and love that have been around for far longer than 13, 14 months that cannot claim that level of, you know, kind of corporate partner in their buyer list. So I think that's really interesting. And then the other thing about this company is that they are operating. So let me back up for a second. When we think about a lot of the carbon removal purchases that have already happened, they have been from companies, benefiting companies that operate in the US or in Northern Europe. And the Next 150 is very different from that. These facilities are in Mexico and they are deliberately so. In fact, it's part of their core part of their strategy that they are doing carbon removal in emerging economies. And this is going to be a theme that comes up in another one of our news items later, but I think that that is absolutely fascinating. That's the trend that we should all be picking up on and looking at. Like, is this going to be something that continues in the future? Are we going to see more geographical diversification, a more global distribution to carbon markets? And is that a good thing? I mean, it seems good because it's sort of spreading carbon wealth around and it's creating buy-in from local economies and it's potentially, you know, sort of leveraging comparative advantage that certain geographies have. I mean, Mexico produces a lot of agricultural waste that is then fairly cheap to process into biochar as compared to in other locales where you have to, you know, obtain those input feedstocks in a different way. But it also probably has cultural and political ramifications that are hard to foresee today. But I just think it's a very big deal that this very new company operating in Mexico was able to sell any amount of carbon credits, let alone 22,000, which is, you know, not huge, but it's not tiny, to Shell. So I think it's pretty cool. And it's something that I'll definitely be keeping an eye on in the future.
So Naeem, you kind of touched on this briefly, but what do you think public perception will be of Shell, you know, a purchase by Shell? There's, I think, a lot of division within the carbon removal, you know, space about working with oil and gas. What's your thinking around this?
Yeah, there is. You're absolutely right about that. And I think public perception for Shell will be, you know, this is more greenwashing, right? And I think ultimately the perception for Shell is going to be like, how does this fit within your broader set of activities as relates to climate? But in terms of like how this helps or, you know, or potentially hurts biochar as a carbon removal solution, I think this helps biochar as a carbon removal solution. Like purchases help companies. Like if this was like kind of Shell buying this particular company and then deciding what to do with it, I would not be able to answer this question. But because I fundamentally think that, you know, carbon removal companies need, you know, sources of revenue and validation that comes from purchases in order to grow and expand, like I see this as as something that helps biochar as a carbon removal solution. And then, you know, when I think about Puro as like a certifying body, I think like, I don't know how much of an impact it has on Puro in particular. I don't know that as Puro, the group that sells or facilitates the sale of these carbon credits should be the certifying body necessarily. But I will just say like net positive purchases for carbon removal credits are net positive, and it should be celebrated whoever it comes from. But we'll have to see how the public perception breaks down for Shell in particular.
So Susan, I don't know if you know this, but do you have a sense of how these purchases fit within Shell's broader environmental strategy?
Well, I mean, the short answer is I don't have a lot of context on this, but I will say one thing we haven't mentioned yet is that this purchase has been by Shell Environmental Products, not Shell overall. And that's different. So it's not necessarily Shell buying credits to offset their enormous, considerable, you know, scope 1, 2, or 3 emissions, or even just like scope 1 for Shell. This is, I think Shell Environmental Products operate somewhat as a reseller. So they build portfolios of credits, and then they work with their different partners and enterprise customers on their carbon strategies. So they have a whole pretty built out and seemingly rigorous team and framework for evaluating anything that they bring into the portfolio. So I think it's kind of a vote of confidence that it's gone through that screening and they're willing to offer it, because it's almost like more, right? If you're going to sell it to your customers than if you're just going to consume it for yourself, right? Like if you're going to serve somebody a meal, you're going to make sure it's better than you would do if you were just making lunch for yourself. And so that's kind of an interesting thing to notice, which, you know, you hear in the name Shell and it actually means so many things, right? So that like which entity within Shell is doing this purchase and why. And then also I'll just call out that something interesting about Shell Environmental Products carbon credits portfolio is that they do tend to look for opportunities that seem to have some kind of story value in addition to simply being, you know, the transaction of the credits and having, you know, kind of the verifiability of the credits themselves. And that's because, you know, they're, I don't know if reseller is the accurate, you know, way to talk about their business model, but they do have to sort of promote these on to their own partners, their own clients. And so the narrative piece is really important. And that's where I think being able to say we're, you know, doing this not just from the usual suspects, but in these, you know, unusual regions, unusual for carbon removal so far, but maybe not for the future. And there's this kind of other feel good aspect to it. I think that's important too. And as the, you know, the broader implication for this is that as carbon removal continues to diversify, and there's just so much now, which is really cool. But I think part of the unique selling proposition for different carbon removal solutions is going to have to be that narrative value. It's not simply price. I think price is for sure number one, and that'll be a given. But then on top of price, let's say all else being equal, how else do you compete? I do think being able to come out with really strong story value, if you're a supplier, is important. So like we're getting into, it's like crazy that it's happening so soon, but we're kind of like getting into the marketing era for carbon removal, which I actually personally think is really exciting and fun.
So Naeem, last question for you on this topic is what challenges do you see in the long-term viability and effectiveness of biochar projects in countries like the US and Canada, where maybe they're feedstock is much higher than a competing, you know, facility in Mexico?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the key challenges that we need to think about in terms of the long-term viability of biochar projects is, you know, one of them is kind of getting to the point that you referenced earlier, Radhika, was around the just How much do we know about biochar as an effective carbon removal method? You know, are there, you know, are some of the questions that exist around durability, measurability, you know, being effectively addressed? You know, how much can we really stand behind biochar as a carbon removal approach? You know, if we think about direct air capture as like the gold standard in terms of just knowing, you know, what we're exactly paying for, and we know direct air capture has its own set of challenges. But like, how does it compare in terms of some of these MRV pieces? I think it's going to be, I think, important in terms of the long-term viability and effectiveness of biochar being able to attract capital long-term. And so, you know, I think purchases like the one we've seen from Shell here are, you know, useful, but I think ultimately, you know, for the long-term viability and effectiveness of biochar, that's going to come down to just like the overall climate and environmental benefits that are claimed. I think biochar is pretty far along in a lot of ways in terms of scalability today, but I still think that there's some questions in those areas that need to be resolved. And I think that's going to really drive the long-term viability here.
Yeah, that could be a generic comment for all open systems, probably. Let's pivot to Jack a little bit and air travel. So as I'm sure most of our listeners know, air travel is still considered a very hard to decarbonize sector. And it's pretty expensive to decarbonize this industry as well. So Naeem, starting with you again, how do you think direct air capture complements Swiss and Lufthansa's group's existing efforts to reduce emissions, i.e. sustainable aviation fuel, which is very expensive?
Yeah, well, I'm glad we're talking about this because it lets me get on my soapbox and complain about sustainable aviation fuel, because I had the opportunity to look into this when I kind of had a project with Clean Air Task Force around sustainable aviation fuel and wrote a white paper with them, which I can send a link on, around just like the fact that a lot of what we consider to be sustainable aviation fuel is by no means sustainable. These aviation biofuels have a lot of challenges in terms of their land use impacts, in terms of their LCAs, in terms of like the sustainable, you know, the supply chain challenges that a lot of these face in terms of when you think about what it's going to take to scale up biofuels for the aviation sector. And so what we frequently call sustainable aviation fuel, we really like the term, like, we should be driving for is zero carbon aviation fuels or low carbon aviation fuels, because sustainable aviation fuels can have a pretty high carbon footprint, and I don't think people really fully realize that. I also had the opportunity to talk to, you know, Anna Stukas from Carbon Engineering about this, and they're thinking about sustainable aviation fuel and how the aviation sector can use direct air capture. And like, even when you have the best sustainable aviation fuel, you're going to have residual emissions from that process as well. And so I think direct air capture is a great complement for airlines like Swiss and Lufthansa to consider in their efforts to reduce emissions, because aviation, for so many reasons, not just the fact that sustainable aviation fuel is hard to come by and is expensive and has a number of challenges, as you rightly pointed out, Radhika, I think that, like, you know, you think about all the other elements of like what it's going to take to get, you know, the aviation sector to zero. And it feels almost impossible, you know, without outright and complete demand destruction for flying. And so we think direct air capture technology and at Carbon Removal Canada can be a great complement in general for the aviation sector, and especially outside of the commercial aviation sector in terms of, like, you know, military uses of aircraft and things like that. So I think that we should, I think when I think about where's a really, like, what's a great sweet spot for direct air capture technology, I think it's within the aviation sector to help them reduce emissions, because it is turning out that something that turns out to be probably in some ways more expensive and even more supply constrained than direct air capture in the near to medium term, it might actually be sustainable aviation fuel, or at least the good sustainable aviation fuel. And so that's kind of a really great place for folks in the direct air capture space to play.
Susan, so what are the expected volumes of carbon dioxide removal from this partnership? And what do you think of its impact, maybe both environmentally and sort of from a business perspective?
Well, that's the interesting part, Radhika. It actually is cleverly omitted. The actual volume of purchase is omitted in any kind of announcements that I've seen about the partnership, at least. Look, I mean, I think there's a lot of greenwashing when it comes to air travel and the whole actually, you know, global travel industry. There's obviously so much more that they can do first. I mean, even in terms of efficiency, like, I think these numbers have been improving dramatically, actually, in the last few years. But, you know, there's still only 85% of flights fly full. So that's like another 15% of flights that they're not empty, but they still have seats and they're still flying. And, you know, there's probably a lot of other little things like that that we non-experts don't think about on a regular basis, where we can be looking for, you know, sort of better bang for our emissions buck. First of all, when you see companies kind of do these really splashy announcements without any of the fine print or any of the details, I always get kind of, I feel a little bit skeptical. We're going to talk a little bit more about aviation in our last story, so I'll save some of this for that one. But, you know, I do appreciate the Climeworks comment on this, that a company that is as cost sensitive as any airline would only be doing this if they, you know, have really thought about reduction first. But then, you know, that doesn't really specify the size of this purchase. And by the way, do we all know how much PR costs? Like, PR is pretty expensive. And if you can get like an amazing PR bump from this, you know, it might just be, and I'm like very, this is a very cynical comment, but I think we in the carbon removal community need to be really aware of that. Like, are these purchases actually land and expand purchases, or are they simply, you know, flyer checks, as we call them in venture, where, you know, they're sort of just like never meant to be anything more than something kind of surface level to get the story value out there on the part of the buyer. And I think it's our job as people who talk about carbon removal publicly and, you know, sort of commentate on it, to be really, to be realists about this and not to be overly, not to play into the narrative trap too much. So I'll kind of just leave it at that. I'm a little bit, as you can tell, I'm a little bit skeptical of this one overall, specifically because why don't we know how much it is or how much money it cost? Those are sort of the key factors that will give confidence and a real concrete underpinning for the industry, and they're missing here.
All right. Well, I'm going to switch us to the last topic that Susan alluded to, which is coming from the Copenhagen Airport, another initiative out of the aviation industry, where Copenhagen's airport is partnering with Compatriot carbon dioxide removal marketplace Climate. So, Susan, how do you see this impacting the perception of the aviation industry commitment to net zero goals? And as you mentioned, there are a lot of other ways potentially where they could get to net zero, like filling up their planes.
I don't know if Taylor Swift has something to do with this, as she seems to have something to do with everything, but there's been so much attention on flight emissions lately. And I think it affects, I mean, you know, these people, these executives at these companies, whether it's an airport executive or an airline executive, they see what's in the headlines. And I think it's kind of made them hustle a little bit. And I think to answer the question specifically, how do I see it impacting the perception? Well, they are definitely thinking, how is this going to impact perception? And we hope positively. And I think that's fine to a certain extent. But again, to connect back to my previous comment, we have to be realists about whether this is a land and expand or whether it just kind of stops at checking the box and, you know, we get some of the PR lift from it and then we quietly, you know, go away once this whole thing blows over. I will also say one thing that's kind of cool or interesting about this story that goes back to our first one about the next 150 is that the purchase is actually, that the Kastrup Airport purchase is actually investing in carbon removal projects in India and Nepal. So again, this like theme, another theme, which is carbon removal is really starting to become this global supply chain. And wow, gosh, we should talk about that on a whole separate episode, because I think it's going to continue to emerge. I find it fascinating, and I think it's probably positive, and it's probably has some interesting implications for cost. But it's, you know, just a notable thing that this one is not a Climeworks purchase, for example.
Which tees up the next question from Naeem perfectly, which is, how do you think this compares to the Climeworks purchases we just talked about? And also, when you think about sustainable aviation fuel and all the issues you mentioned earlier.
I think it's obviously different in terms of the carbon removal purchases from climate are going to be a variety of short duration and long duration carbon removal methods. But I think, like, generally positive, right, to shift away from avoidance-based credits towards removal-based credits, that's a good thing. And so I think that's great to hear. Ultimately, we see, like, kind of more of an interest around, long duration carbon removal methods with the partnership with Swiss and Lufthansa. Though I think to Susan's point, like, we don't know what the kind of volume of that purchase is going to be, or, you know, what we're, I actually don't know that the airlines really want to commit to anything around that at this stage. Like, I don't know why they would publicize, like, what the volumes of direct air capture credits that they would actually purchase. Like, I think what airlines are realizing is sustainable aviation fuel is hard to come by and is extremely expensive. We better lock up some other alternatives here. And I'm very happy about, for, like, I would say, for, like, the splashy announcements of airlines working with direct air capture companies around their work here, even if they can't be very specific around what they want to do. We need to just see more companies seeing the value of even just understanding why they should be thinking about something like direct air capture in the first place. And just like, we just need to see the news that's released from Copenhagen, you know, the airport in Copenhagen around ditching avoidance-based credits for you know, removal-based credits with a marketplace like Climate. Generally speaking, like, I'm kind of worried about people working in carbon removal, and those of us have been working in this for a while, on just, like, burnout of just, like, we got to be able to celebrate some of these wins here. Like, this is, like, we were in a position where we were hopeful that maybe, like, we would see something where, you know, the DOD would maybe buy some, get into, like, investing in research and development for direct air capture for aviation fuel that they might be able to use on a military base somewhere so many years down the line. And recently we're seeing all this great, you know, policy wins around carbon removal. We're seeing, you know, major companies buying carbon removal, or, you know, partnering with carbon removal companies. Like, we got to take the wins where we can get them. And we've got to be able to say, like, hey, this is a step in the right direction. Like, Swiss and Lufthansa run, you know, and the airline industry in general, not an easy business to be in, not an easy business to take some of your profits and go and buy several hundred dollar a ton carbon removal credits. But they're doing it. At least they're announcing that they'd like to do it. And that's a move in the positive direction. And I really think it's important that when companies go and do this, and they do it for the PR bump, of course, they do it for the greenwashing, of course, but, like, they have to have a basis in which to justify some of these decisions to their investors, especially, in particular, if they're working in sectors that are not, that they're not held down by kind of compliance requirements or whatever mandates that are existing to reduce their emissions. So there needs to be that PR bump. We need to show that we have, that we need to let them kind of play the PR card if we want them to continue doing this. And certainly there's a role that we can play to be like, hey, like, a year ago, Swiss and Lufthansa, you know, they announced some Climeworks partnership. I wonder if anything ever came of that. We should look into it, and we should make sure that we call them out if that was, in fact, just a PR announcement and nothing real came of it. But I do think, like, all of this stuff that we talked about today, like the biochar purchase, the partnership with Swiss and Lufthansa and Climeworks, the Copenhagen airport investment, like these are all positive developments for carbon removal. And I think we got to remind ourselves of that, because when you, like Radhika, you've been in this for a long time now, it's, you're like running up against a wall a lot of the time. And you kind of just need to be like, you know what? Wasn't perfect. I wish Swiss and Lufthansa said they were buying X number of tons over this amount of time, and this is what they were going to, absolutely. But like, we will run out of gas as a community of people who care about this topic if we don't take the wins where we can get them and then just continue to build on them. And the building on the wins is what I've, frankly, that's what I've seen over the last few years. And that's been really positive. So Copenhagen Airport, like, do I wish they just focus on durable carbon removal? Yeah, I wish it was just durable carbon removal. But the fact that their, you know, announcement said we're ditching avoidance-based credits for carbon removal credits, that's a huge win. That's great. We should celebrate that. And so just to say, like, I would also just want to say, like, I also agree with Susan on how exciting it is that this sector is showing that it can have a real impact in places around the world. When I originally got started working in carbon removal, I'd only hear about projects or pilots or ideas around carbon removal that were very focused in the US or Europe. And as someone who worked in international development and lived in other parts of the world, I'd always wondered, like, when is this going to become a more international industry? And when are we going to be able to talk about carbon removal in Kenya and India and China and Vietnam and all these other places in Mexico, and outside of the US and Europe context? And we finally are. And that's really great news too.
All right. Well, I'm almost don't want to bring up the next topic because it was nice to end on something so positive, but I did promise Susan and Naeem we would touch on one last thing, which is, I think, really important to discuss, which is a recent study from ETH Zurich that basically questioned whether DAC pricing could get to the levels of $200 or lower, even $100, which is thrown out there a lot. So Susan, I'm going to turn it over to you because I know that you were really interested in the study. And can you give us an overview and what it said, basically?
Yeah, so a group of researchers at ETH Zurich in collaboration with another institution actually found that they did a bunch of cost analysis looking at experience curves for different subcomponents for direct air capture. And they found that for, three exemplary direct air capture technologies that they chose to call out, specifically liquid solvent systems, such as carbon engineering, solid sorbent direct air capture, which would be Climeworks, and then calcium oxide ambient weathering, which would be Heirloom, that for those three types, and they're not, you know, covering all the potential flavors of DAC that are increasingly proliferating and, you know, very much at the frontier of technology development. But just for these three, for companies that we know well and that are often kind of held up as examples in the space, that they did not see costs getting to $100 per ton, which, Radhika, as you've mentioned, it gets thrown out there a lot. Nobody's ever said that. So I think it comes from Frontier. And Frontier has been very careful never to say DAC is going to be at $100 per ton, but because they said $100 a ton is that sort of price target, I think it just kind of got out there. And then the International Energy Agency picked up on it. The World Economic Forum also says that DAC should and can be at 100. So there are like some pretty legitimate institutions out there saying these prices, but this research found by looking at all of the subcomponents that go into DAC that was not feasible by 2050, and that prices would be more in the median range of, you know, 340 to 370, but that they would have ranges from as low as $230 per ton, which is getting there, is close, as high as $835 per ton. The calcium oxide ambient weathering, that's Heirloom's approach, had the biggest range. Biggest number of variable factors there. So I just thought this was interesting because, you know, we all, I think, operate under some assumptions around technology cost curves and learning curves that assume that what we've seen in other technologies will, of course, has to map to every technology that's out there. And in fact, it's more helpful to be specific and to be realistic. Like, I agree with Naeem's previous comment about celebrating wins. I also would say that as my job as an investor is not to celebrate wins. My job as an investor is to understand where the market is going and make informed decisions that will honestly generate returns. That's my job. Now, as a climate person, of course, I'd love to celebrate wins, but you know, and in my role in this podcast, I'm both, but investors will want to see that things are getting cheaper, getting more widely adopted, growing. And so that's, you know, just one consideration here that this is going to potentially affect how things go.
So Naeem, I'll turn it over to you now, because within the carbon removal industry, there were some people who questioned some of the outcomes of that study. So if you don't mind kind of discussing what Robert Hoagland posted on his, I think it was on Milky Wire after this came out.
Yeah, that was, I mean, I think everything that Susan said is dead on, in the sense that, like, we have to be careful about how we think about learning curves, especially with something like direct air capture. Like, I don't think it's going to, you know, match the trajectory of solar or batteries or something like that. And I think we have to be clear-eyed about that. I also totally agree. I don't know where we came up with this, like, $100 per ton. I think, Susan, I think you're right. Like, it was thrown about and it just kind of caught on for direct air capture. My hope has been that across a diverse portfolio of carbon, you know, durable carbon removal methods, that we can average out somewhere in that range. But direct air capture is likely always going to be, you know, the most expensive approach here. So, you know, whenever I hear $100 a ton thrown around for direct air capture, I do kind of scratch my head. But Robert did kind of, I think, post something very useful on his Substack, and I hope we can get that on the show notes as well in response to this study, because it was an important study. Listen, you know, when you're talking about carbon engineering, Climeworks, and Heirlooms, direct air capture technologies, like, you're talking about the companies that are probably furthest along in terms of their direct air capture technologies. If you can have an incumbent direct air capture technology, like, those three are amongst the top of the list. So it's important that they're there. But we also know that there's something like 80 to 100 other direct air capture companies working on different technologies right now. And so I don't know how much I would, apply these estimates to, like, what direct air capture looks like 25 years from now. You know, Robert Hoagland references a really great article that should also be in the show notes as well, about how we're at, you know, direct air capture 3.0. And, you know, we can agree whether or not that makes sense. But the point is that we are seeing a lot of innovation in the direct air capture space that is not going to be captured by studies like this, because it would be impractical for a study like this to capture all the different types of and variations of direct air capture that are being tested right now. So I would just say that, like, in general, I think we should be careful about what we're thinking about in terms of the realistic cost reductions around direct air capture. I think that point is very true. But, you know, I also want us to just remember that, like, estimates of, like, where DAC is going to be 25 years from now, based on the more incumbent technologies that exist right now, recognizing that there are emerging direct air capture technologies that are being built by, you know, companies like Mission Zero and, AirHive and, another 80 of them today, right now, that are in development, that I don't know how much we should really take from that study. In terms of the actual costs that they land at, other than to say, let's be realistic about this whole $100 per ton, you know, target that's been thrown around. Like, I agree. I don't know where that's fundamentally coming from or where that's, what that's based on. Anyway, Susan, you were going to say something.
Yeah, Naeem, I think you're right. But, like, going back to something you were just mentioning, even if it's not a relevant commentary on all of direct air capture, which it may or may not be, it is sort of a way to call out the incumbents, which are specifically named, but not in the title, right? It's not saying, hey, carbon engineering, hey, heirloom. And by the way, these companies have raised hundreds of millions of dollars, hundreds, well, maybe even close to $1 billion. And so there are a lot of stakeholders implicated in this. Even if it's only about these three companies, it's still significant because, you know, it's like, hey, maybe the incumbent technology is going to be displaced by something cooler down the road. But for everybody that's already part of the incumbent bandwagon, there are some serious implications. And then I think there's something else I wanted to just mention from the study that relates to a comment that you made earlier, Naeem, which was about sustainable aviation fuels. So, you know, they were careful to say that even at higher costs, in even worst case, and they're not able to really go down the curve and at the higher cost, there's still going to be a very good alternative to sustainable aviation fuels, even if they're at the same price as sustainable aviation fuels, for a bunch of different reasons. Not only that, well, there's all these questions around the real sustainability of sustainable aviation fuels, number one, but even that aside, it's like the scalability of sustainable aviation fuels and having to create biofuel from, I mean, land use competition across so many different use cases, then how are we going to satisfy all that need? And so there, DAC, even at the higher prices, becomes a good alternative. And that's where it wraps actually really nicely back to the story about Swiss and Lufthansa, because they're starting to see that maybe very early on, and they're making a couple of bets. We don't know of what size, but they're making some early bets to hedge. And, you know, this is the exact justification for why they should be doing that, even at the higher prices that DAC might sustain at.
Yeah, 100%. That's such a good point. And I'm glad you brought it back to that point around sustainable aviation fuel. It's like, it's like if we could just get real about where do we actually need carbon removal costs to land at, instead of this in like, you know, arbitrary $100 per ton level, and like, right, you know, we could actually have an informed conversation around what the implications are for a study like this for three, like you said, incumbent direct air capture companies. And I would just say, I think you make a good point around the implications for, you know, these three companies and the technologies that they're using. And I would just love to see how they responded to the study. I haven't looked into that, but I would love to see how they responded to, mm-hmm. To it and how they continue to justify some of the claims they make around the costs that they're looking at, when we know that a study like this can really put that into question.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that we've let a mnemonic, you know, it's a nice round number and easy to remember, but now it's somehow defining an entire industry, and it's arbitrary. Why not $103 or $97?
All right. Well, Naeem, Susan, we are running out of time, but I appreciate, as always, the commentary and thoughts, and look forward to having you on in about a month. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much for listening to Carbon Removal Newsroom. If you like the show, the best way you can help us is by giving us a great rating and review in Apple Podcasts, following the show on Spotify, and by sharing the show on social media. Tell your friends and help us spread the word about what's happening in the world of carbon removal.